Welcome to our weekly Dharma gathering. The Sangha sits in such noble dignity, just like the ancient days. It's so hard to leap out of our various boxes. Mostly because it's very hard to notice that we're in various boxes. Today, Shoho and I were at a restaurant, and we passed by this table where two women were reading a travel guide. You know, those Lonely Planet travel guides, you could kind of like, they have a certain look. So we happened to notice it, and we were just outside the window so we could stop and look a little bit. Oh, where are they going? And the cover of this travel guide said something like, estatis, Unity, Occidental, and the kind of person who's ignorant about a lot of languages. We both had this thought, whoa, that's, we've never heard of that country. Wow, like there's a whole country on the planet that we've never heard of. I mean, I know some countries are changing around a lot, right? Over in, you know, the Soviet Union got all divided up. Maybe it's one of those new little countries. And then it dawned on us that they're not getting ready to travel to another country. They actually looked kind of Middle Eastern. I don't even remember what this name was, but it was the name of the very place we stood. And we thought it was far away and completely unknown. And that shifted perspective when realizing, how could this make sense? And then, of course, a bit like that classic story of looking in fear at the snake and then looking again and seeing it's not a snake, it's merely a rope. So that's an example of like a box that I was in that I didn't even know I was in. Right? A box that if someone's reading a travel guide, it means they're going to some other country. That's just like a given, right? I mean, there's no other alternatives, are there? So it's hard to leap out of such a box when one doesn't even know one is in the box. And this is kind of like the condition of being a sentient being. Being an sentient being box. Yeah. It's hard to leap outside and into Buddha nature. It's a perspective we're not used to. It's like we're like a little cloud. Sometimes a stormy cloud, sometimes a big fluffy cloud, sometimes with very distinct edges, sometimes more like fog and blurring into everything around us. And from the perspective of the cloud that we are, that's all there is. We're just in the cloud. We are the cloud. We're in the cloud. What else could there be? And yet, like, this cloud is floating in something. It's drifting through a completely clear, empty sky. This is, roughly speaking, in the realm of words and metaphors, a bit like us. This little, sometimes stormy, sometimes clear, being in the midst of vast Buddha nature. And in some ways we could even say a cloud forms out of the sky. Moisture in the sky comes together very mysteriously and combines into what we call a cloud right out of the sky. And cloud's not separate from the sky, and yet it kind of blocks the sky too. It blocks the clarity of the sky. So today somebody brought up this section from Suzuki Roshi. We've been talking about in Sunday class Buddha nature. And I think I even recall saying something early in the year, in January maybe, something like, this year I want to dedicate myself to studying and teaching Buddha nature. But of course, there's so many things to talk about that that comes and goes. But we're at the point in the Lankavatara Sutra on Sunday nights where we're talking about Buddha nature. And this section in Zen Mind, Beginner's Mind came up. Suzuki Roshi says, to live in the realm of Buddha nature means to die as a small being, moment after moment. Kind of like as a cloud being to just dissolve back into the sky. Moment by moment means like maybe then we reform again as a new cloud. And we dissolve back into the sky again. To die as a small being moment after moment. When we lose our balance, we die. But at the same time, we also develop ourselves. We grow. So we lose our balance as cloud beings. And die, but as the cloud beings we are, we're also developing ourselves. We're like evolving clouds. Whatever we see is changing, losing its balance. That's whatever we see is in this cloud, because the clear emptiness of the sky we actually don't see. We might say it looks blue, but that's not really the color of the sky anyway, right? It's not like we can actually really see the sky. We're just seeing vastness with no end. But whatever we see is changing and losing its balance. The reason everything looks beautiful is because it's out of balance. But its background is always in perfect harmony. So the realm that we see is losing its balance. It's impermanent. It's constantly changing. It's shifting. It's the realm where all our problems reside. But interestingly, Roshi says, it's also beautiful. This realm of Buddha nature is, I would say, not actually really beautiful. It's beyond beauty and non-beauty. It's just pure suchness. But this world, unchanging, I mean, this world of changing is sometimes very beautiful and sometimes not. Beauty is relative to non-beauty. The Japanese people love cherry blossoms so much. They think they're so exquisitely beautiful because they're constantly losing their balance. They last a very short time. They're very impermanent. Thus, they're very beautiful. So the reason everything looks beautiful is because it's out of balance, but its background is always in perfect harmony. This is how everything exists in the realm of Buddha nature, losing its balance against a background of perfect balance. So if you see things without realizing the background of Buddha nature, everything appears to be in the form of suffering. Sometimes beautiful suffering, but suffering nonetheless. But if you understand the background of existence, you realize that suffering itself is how we live and how we extend our life. So in Zen, sometimes we emphasize the imbalance or disorder of life. We don't just emphasize the empty sky. We emphasize taking care of the mess. And the leaves fall in the garden. And we don't just say that they're not leaves. We actually like rake them up and then they fall again in perfect imbalance. And we'll rake them up again. And they fall again. And we rake them up again. And sometimes that's very beautiful. That's one of the particular beautiful things about a tree in a garden, is the imbalance of dropping all those leaves and then having to work to clean them up. But all of that's happening in this larger field, in this, against this background of Buddha nature. So how can such a leap happen out of our conditioned cloud-like box? One way in our lineage that's spoken of is trust. Dogen Zenji says in one of his very early writings, regarding trust in Buddha nature, those who practice the Buddha way should first of all trust in the Buddha way. Those who trust in the Buddha way, what does this mean? They should trust that they are, in essence, within the Buddha way. Or, in other words, trust that they are this cloud floating in this vast spaciousness of clear, empty sky of no hindrance. We should trust that we are, in essence, within the Buddha way, where there is, in such a vast sky, no delusion, no false thinking, no confusion, no increase or decrease, and no mistake. to arouse such trust and illuminate the way in this manner and to practice accordingly are fundamental in studying the way. Again, a bit difficult to trust something that we actually can't see, hear, taste, touch, smell, or conceptualize. So that's why none of those ways actually are the essential practice. Trying to see, hear, taste, smell, touch, conceptualize the Buddha way is never reaches it ultimately. It may be helpful to talk like we are now to point to the territory. But this trust doesn't need those usual dualistic experiences to operate. It's just trust. So again, we might say, well, how do you trust? How do we trust this Buddha way that's has no delusion, no false thinking, no confusion, no increase or decrease, and no mistake? You do this by sitting, which cuts the root of thinking. Then, let body and mind drop off and let go of delusion and enlightenment. So, we have such a practice. Sitting, opening the tight grip of conceptual thought. With developing trust and with trust that we're letting go into the sky that holds us, this spaciousness. So trust seems so essential. Trusting this background, this inconceivable nature. Also, I think trust is developed by understanding it more and more clearly, so thus we continue to have teachings clarifying what is meant by Buddha nature. Not anywhere else is partly what it is. Right here with us, but maybe more truly we could say as us. It is who we actually are. So we don't have to create it, find it, improve it, shine it up, or anything at all. Just trust and open. And then related to trusting and opening to Buddha nature, in the world, in the cloud world where we live, we can also develop the trust in Buddha nature by trusting the world of things and people and each other. In some ways, maybe this is more difficult, even though it's more tangible. Because Buddha nature, we know, is never going to betray us. So if we trust it, it offers nothing but its compassionate embrace. Buddha nature has such qualities too. But people, this is more challenging. So How can we, especially as a Sangha, as the spiritual community, how can we trust each other? You know, we might not know each other so well. We might know each other over a long time. And in either case, it may be difficult to trust. But I think this is part of the offering of Sangha, is the opportunity to develop this kind of trust, which may result in betrayal, because we're just cloud-like, foolish little creatures running about in our box, our various boxes. And yet, the way we can trust each other is to trust not so much our box nature, but our Buddha nature, because the teaching is that this is who we really are. So when we meet someone, can we meet like Buddha nature to Buddha nature? It's not our usual way, because it's so imperceptible. But through trust in Buddha nature, through our trust in our own Buddha nature, we can trust others' Buddha nature. Through trusting others' Buddha nature, we can trust our own. And difficult, I think. But again, I think Sangha, when we have a community like this that hopefully can be built on trust, it's a beautiful vision. And then within the Sangha, we each have our unique Dharma position. Like it's like the way that the rest of the Sangha is creating us. And if we look closer, the rest of the Sangha here means the rest of the entire universe. The global Sangha creates our Dharma position. This is one of Dogen's terms. Our Dharma position is our independent momentary expression, just like this right now, but completely dependent at the same time on everything and everyone else in the universe. Independent of past and future, and dependent on past and future. That's how a moment of ash exists. Dependent on the firewood and completely independent of the firewood at the very same time, inconceivably. That's the Dharma position of that piece of ash. And we're like that. We each have our Dharma position. And it's like who we are. It's like our expression in the world. It's like the manifestation of our cloud against this background of clear sky, ever changing, and yet beautiful, sometimes excruciatingly beautiful, but beautiful because it's nothing else like it. Our Dharma position is totally unlike any other Dharma position. And we give that to each other. We create that for each other. Inevitably, whether we like it or not, we're all creating each other right now in our Dharma position. And then we, like, in the Zen Center community, we also, like, formally enact that at the same time. So we did this little ceremony the other day where we two people changed Dharma position after morning service. Reverend Patrick, who's been at Eno for many, many years, did a little circumambulation, bowing to everyone in the room at that time, and basically like handed over, kind of ritually handed over his Dharma position of Eno to Edie, who received that Dharma position as a co, you know. And so they each have their Dharma position like way beyond these little roles in the Zen center, and yet we play with Dharma positions in the Zen center in those kind of ways. And now Evie abides for the moment, could be a very short moment, as in this particular Dharma position of what we call Eno, the, you know, managing the Zendo. And so can we trust, as a practice, can we trust her in her Dharma position as Eno, and like, we trust you to take care of that, and she might do it in a completely different way than Patrick. And is that okay? It's like we've given it to her. Whether it was, I mean, this is the realm where there's no mistakes. The Buddha, in the Buddha nature realm, there's no mistakes. In the cloud-like box realm, we could say, oh, maybe that was a mistake. Oh, no. Now we have to wait till the Dharma position changes again to another Eno. But in the larger container, see, all these things are working at the same time. The larger container, there is never any mistake. So we could ask somebody like out on the street, oh, excuse me, can you be Eno now? I mean, they do this at in Japan. They all priests at some point have to take up the Dharma, all Soto Zen priests, there's like tens of thousands of them in Japan, they all pretty much all have to take up the Dharma position of being the abbot of a Heiji, which is like the temple, the head temple of Soto Zen. Sometimes say the Vatican of Soto Zen, right? They have to be abbot of the head monastery for one day. Oh. And it's like done in such a way that the kind of longer term abbot is still like doing the job of the abbot there. But I don't know, maybe strictly speaking, they actually, at the day when somebody is doing that ceremony, that person's not the abbot. I don't know how they think of that. But that's my understanding, is that they take up that Dharma position. We could say that's ridiculous. But it's playing with this idea of Dharma positions. And can the hundreds of practitioners at Eheiji trust that when that person is abbot for the day at Eheiji, that they won't say, as abbot, I now decree that we're going to turn the Buddha hall upside down. No, no, you can't do it. You're just abbot for the day. But I've never heard of anyone trying to do that. I think they just do trust, you know. So so we have these various positions, and so it's something that I sometimes think about in this Dharma position that's called head teacher for the time being, that's been that seems to have been created due to various innumerable causes and conditions of within this little group in this room, and with like a larger group, and the whole universe has made it, which it could be like a major mistake from the cloud perspective. From the big perspective, no mistake. But you know, what is, I don't really know what that is. And maybe nobody knows really what that is. I wonder sometimes, can the Sangha, the community in each of your Dharma positions, trust this particular Dharma position, which is all it is, just a temporary thing. But it's kind of scary, because it comes along with, as I understand it, in my limited, you know, cloud-like understanding, it comes along with responsibility to like maybe make changes at the Zen Center and stuff like that. So it may be particularly difficult to trust. So So then we maybe keep, we shift the positions or we redefine things. And so we're always in this process. And for me, it's a very lively thing. Since I've got here, basically, at Zen Center, is understanding all my Dharma position and everyone's Dharma position. And I, you know, what comes to mind recently about this is trust. Like, can I trust everybody else's Dharma position? And can they trust that this Dharma position, this temporary condition to set up? And then can we totally play in that realm? I think that's the benefit of, if we trust it, then it's like we trust people to just enact their Dharma position with as much integrity as possible. Then can we like play, which might look kind of wild, or it might look like not like we think it should look, or it might be not beautiful, or it might be very beautiful, it might be beautiful beyond our imagination. So for me, it's hard and frightening sometimes to trust each being's Dharma position and each person in the Sangha, but also outside the Sangha. Actually, I think it's harder often outside the Sangha because we have some shared understanding about practice in the Sangha. So, with all that in mind, that little piece of shifting cloud this evening, I wonder if you all have any comments or questions or concerns or doubts. Maybe a question to throw out for your contemplation and consideration is what would it take to like completely all trust each other, which may result in total disaster. But what would it take as a practice to do that? Yes.
I find it difficult to trust all of the objects in this room. I find it somewhat easier, however, to cultivate my willingness to show up vulnerable, to soften my opinion of what makes me me.
That's kind of like trust.
Well, I think I think faith for me is cultivating a willingness to show up vulnerable, and trust is showing up that way. So, if I just work on softening my defenses and my armor and my own excellent way of attacking and all that, in other words, if I strip down, I can see that there is no threat from anything. So I think if it's possible for all the people in the Sangha to trust each other, I think it has something to do with cultivating faith.
And why would you say there's no threat?
I think if I am practicing vulnerability myself, I am living a demonstration that I don't have to be protected. That protection, either defensive or offensive, is unnecessary.
But very solid and sharp pieces of cloud might get flung at you.
Well, what's really interesting is that the less armor I have and the less paraphernalia to attack with I'm carrying around, the more agile I am. So
to dodge the pieces.
I'm more like a fly. I mean, I aspire to be a fly.
I mean, partly I was asking because I had the image of, I think this is another way to open to this larger background of Buddha nature, a way to leap outside the box that we don't even know we're in, is vulnerability. Yeah, so I wondered if maybe a part of the reason there's no threat is because the more we see the spaciousness outside the box, in that realm, in that sky, there is, by definition, there's never any threat. There's no death and no birth and no harm and no benefit. By relaxing into our open vulnerability, the more the cloud box starts to become one of those really wispy clouds where the sky is kind of like shining through it and circulating through it. Yes. Yes.
My opinion doesn't count, both because I'm the new kid on the block and I'm leaving before anyone even gets to know me.
But your opinion is your Dharma position created by all of us. So it counts more than anything else in the whole universe. Right now.
Okay. So let's see. A couple of thoughts arose in relationship to this. One is that my experience has been that, at least in my life, pretty much everything is at least a partial disaster. And the key is to just not assume that means there's anything wrong. So that's, you know, that really helps with the willingness to show up and be vulnerable and just kind of more or less let things happen the way they will. I mean, other than, you know, trying to be sure that people don't get hurt if it's really easy to help them not be hurt.
And yet, why is it that in a disaster zone there's nothing wrong?
That's just my current working hypothesis.
So I wonder if, too, you might not say it this way, but I wonder if that's like the nothing wrong is like little bits and pieces of blue sky shining
into the cloud.
Maybe
that would be a workable metaphor, yes. And the other point is, again, new kid on the block, but no biases based on existing group dynamics. I have seen you in a Dharma position like this, 6 months in one place and coming up on 6 months in another place. And I find that my actual, honest to God, in the body, in the mind, present moment response is, God, Kokyo just is fabulous.
Well, that's your Dharma position.
That's my Dharma
moment. And from my point of view, that's beautiful. But that's just my Dharma position. Yes. Chris.
I've over the years had some very strong experiences during Sesshin. And during one Sesshin, I had some reason to believe that my Dharma position was maybe to get whacked over the head and someone running off was the money that I was holding as venture straw, which was thousands of dollars. And so I sat with apprehension and fear and uncertainty very strongly throughout the whole retreat. For me, the carrot at the Zen, on the Zen stick has always been the phrase to drop off skin and to become one with the universe. And on the last day of Sesshin, the universe said, come on, do it. You can do it right now. You just have to give up all your fears and take that leap. Just, you can't do anything. Every person you meet can be your very best friend from the first second. There's nothing to stop you from doing anything. You might die, it might kill you, you might end up mangled. But if you drop your fear, you can really do this. And it was almost a physical sensation of the universe offering its hand, and I couldn't do it. And I never perceived myself really as a coward. But I couldn't stay in that mental place. You have to step down sooner.
Yeah.
But I will always remember it. And by giving up on at least some of my fear, and by through remembering that place, it has become so much easier to be more radically open with every new person, and to not have my defenses that used to be extremely well developed to just pat them down on the head. This was all right. And it's actually quite amazing how easy it is to love everybody when the fear is not so strong.
Yeah. Fear is a good term to bring up, because that's the pivot of trust. Trust and fear are like the are kind of bumping against each other. Or you could say fear is the blockage to trust, and trust is the blockage to fear, the hindrance to fear. So again, we can't, like you say, we can't stay there in the cloud form. Cloud form is, it, by its nature, it's contracting into various types of fear. But the sky that the cloud is in is the fearless realm. So it's like we can, you know, if the cloud gets in touch with that, then that's the realm. Yeah, it's fearless because it can't be harmed. Or like, what did Johnny say? It can't, there's no threat. Yeah. For a moment, and then in the cloud. But you can't do that. It might hurt. Yeah. Thank you.
It does hurt sometimes.
Yeah.
That's all right.
Mm-hmm.
It's not really a problem.
Mm-hmm. Like Russ's, it's, what is it, chaos?
Disaster doesn't mean anything's wrong.
Disaster doesn't mean anything's wrong. Does anybody think it might not be a good idea to trust everyone? I mean, it could. I know somebody in the Sangha whose car window got smashed, and so now she just leaves her windows down and the doors unlocked. And just like, you know, people can go in there if they want, and they do. And they rummage through her maps and stuff, but actually they don't take the maps because they're not to the place that they want to go, I guess. But interesting practice, you know. It's challenging for me after living for years in a bunch of different communities, all of which have no locks on the doors, and they're public places. Anybody can walk in there, walk into your room, and take anything they want, and sometimes they do. But even though they sometimes do, those communities have said, we still don't want locks on the doors. And it's a little bit hard for me to come to a place where, so far, I felt like when I leave the house to usually lock the doors, at least for a longer time. And I wonder, that's kind of playing with things. It's like, well, what would it be more beneficial to my practice to actually have to buy like another computer or something every month? It might be. Sometimes I think it might be, you know. Just for that month in between to be like, wow, come back and like anyone could have just taken everything, but they didn't. How do we trust like all beings, like best intentions and Buddha nature, even though they will try their hardest to get us to not trust them again and again. It's kind of stupid to trust them. Yeah. And yet, isn't it joyful? Yes.
I'm just meaning to bring this up, but I will. What if one of the boxes comes to you and sort of says, I don't trust you, where it's coming back from the outside, from another person, where the trust is, I don't trust you?
Yeah. Yeah, what then?
Yeah, what then?
Can we, yeah, then comes this practice challenge of then can we actually, then we have two choices, it seems like. Then we can go into the box, or then I don't trust you either. And then that's, we live our life like that and eventually die anyway. And everything will be taken from us, and including our life. Or we can say like, this is totally not fair because you don't trust me, but I'm going to trust you anyway. These great classic stories like, Les Miserables. Do you know that one? I think, as I recall, it's like, you know, the thief comes and, to the Zen center and, takes, all the statues and bells and stuff, and then the police then like catch him on the street full of like Zen equipment, and they take him in handcuffs back to the temple, and say and go to the priest there and say like, we caught the thief, this is your stuff, right? He stole it from you. And the priest said, No, I gave it to him. Which he didn't, actually, right? And the thief was shocked. So that's like a case where the thief was like, totally didn't trust what was happening. He didn't trust the police. He's like, this thief's gonna not, I mean, the priest is now going to get me locked up, so I have no trust there. What a strange thing, right? No, I gave those to him. And then, so they let him go. And then the thief comes back the next day and says, I don't understand. I just took everything of yours. Why did you say that? And the priest says something like, it's okay. No, I really did give them to you. And now that they're back here, would you like them again? Or would you like to come actually like live here? Since you're like a homeless, poor wanderer and you're in need of bells. I don't remember the story exactly, but I think that's what happened. He lived there. The priest, he was just a thief. He had thief nature through and through. Always a thief. And the this priest actually trusted him. And I think, fill me in if you know the story more, but I think after like living there for many years, totally befriending the priest, at some point he stole everything and left again. Is that right? Does anyone know that story? I think he was like, you know, the total trust ended in betrayal again. After building up all this trust, and like it was going to be this great story of like conversion of the thief to total trust, he took advantage of it. Took everything again, I think is how it ended up. And then, but I think that the thief didn't say, well, I forget that practice now. Next person who comes, we'll lock him up. And then again, and again, everyone in the end died. with poorer or richer than when they were born, with more wounds or less wounds than when they were born, more friends or less friends than when they were born, and then life goes on, new life happens, and so. So that's one possibility. That's one possible response to when someone doesn't trust, to actually just trust them and just kind of naively and foolishly say, "Well, you don't have to, but I trust you anyway." But very, very challenging, I think, to do that. What do you think? Is that stupid? Is it stupid?
No.
It's challenging. I mean, it could be, it, practically speaking, it could be stupid because you might lose a lot of stuff, right? But is it worth it? Yes?
Just dovetailing on that, I was thinking, you know, quite a bit about this very subject today, about whether how we behave should depend on how other people behave.
Yeah.
There's a practical, logistical, real-life aspect in which, to some extent, yes, it just would be, you know, really logistically complicated if it just never mattered to you in any way how other people behaved, and that never, ever impacted your own behavior. So I'm setting aside that extreme. But it, I think that to a large extent, how other people behave toward us should not affect how we choose to behave. We should do what we think is right, regardless of whether other people validate us for it or not. What do you think?
It's very tricky, right? Because, yeah, I think in general, I think the tricky part comes in with what we think is right, right? Because part of the vulnerability is being really open to feedback from the universe and like, oh, actually, didn't think that someone with a travel guide might not be going to another country. I never thought of that before. So like, oh, I now have a different view of what I'd like to do now. So I think we're still open. But then in the end, like I still, with all the information I currently have, I still feel like this would be the best thing. And of course, and knowing that it's total delusion, because anything in the box, anything in the cloud is by nature delusion. And but still, in the realm of delusion, we have to act. And can we, in the deluded realm, can we act like to the best of our intention in accord with the cloudless? Yes.
In relationship to acting in accord, it seems like sometimes the right choice might be to say, for example, if someone tells me they don't trust me, well, what is it about this relationship that's not trustworthy right now?
Yeah.
And examine it together.
Mm-hmm.
What do we need to do to make it right?
That's great. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Well, it might be a sense of inquiry that we could engage.
Mm-hmm. If there's enough trust from the other person to even have the conversation.
Absolutely.
Takes that. Yeah. Takes that. That's a good one, yeah.
If you trust the person coming up to me and telling that person that he doesn't trust me, he's already expressing trust.
Yeah, and vulnerability.
Mm-hmm.
Big one, yeah, big vulnerability. Yeah, it's much easier to not trust someone and not say anything about it. So, a great point, again, I think for building intimacy, vulnerability, and trust in the Sangha, maybe that starts with the foundation of like radical honesty, total honesty. That's another thing I think of, you know, if particularly in my Dharma position, if people are like, well, we actually, we don't want to rock the boat or something, so, we don't really like this idea you have, we'll go along, but we won't tell you that. We'll go along with it anyway. That I think is in the long run is going to be a big problem. But if everybody's really honest, then we can say, oh, but why don't you like it? And then we talk about it and we see, oh, well, there's a misunderstanding from both sides maybe about what we're actually even talking about or whatever. Yeah. Honesty is a huge, huge one. How can we cultivate that? Yes.
So you, if I recall, you lived at Tassajara or the San Francisco Zen Center. Did they attach that there, total honesty, like radical honesty?
There was a lot of discussion about trying to do that, right? So I think there was, you know, people are people, so... But particularly among ongoing people who would be working together, making decisions and things like that, there was more discussion than there would probably be in other settings about let's cultivate radical honesty. And one of the ways that I, for several years, one of the main themes of discussion at Tassajara was about feedback. Can we actually, as a training mode, are we open to giving and receiving feedback? Very challenging, you know, because people would say like, yeah, sounds cool, let's do it, that's radical. And then when it comes down to it, well, are you ready for some now?
Oh. Yeah.
I'm
ready to give
it. Yeah, ready to. Yeah, so.
I mean, it's also just logistical issues. I mean, I really don't think one can be radically honest with everyone because there's just not enough time.
Yeah. Practically speaking, I think that's often true. But that's why we can have, like, in a sangha, in a contained situation where we have some agreements, for example, like bodhisattva precepts is a huge one. I think that's part of why we do this. We agree on practicing certain kinds of the intention to be non-harmful to each other through these precepts. And then we, with that background, then we can say, now let's give feedback, but we're still in accord, but give feedback in accord with the precepts. We have precepts like not speaking of others' faults and not praising self at the expense of others and not lying. So like with those, diligently attending to these precepts, then can we give and receive feedback. So, but in the world at large where people don't have those commitments, it's much harder, I think. Yes. Last question, I think, is what I'm about to...
I think the word trust seems so loaded, and it seems like this block of something, you know, and it's really a continuum and situational, and so, yeah, it almost seems like a word that I'd rather just not even hear.
Can you...
About things like feedback and these different communication and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
But I can't, I mean... Because if you say you don't trust somebody, they're like, you don't trust me? And then, you know,
yeah.
I'm in this case, and I'm in this case.
Yeah, it's big. If we just say, I don't trust you, it's like, it's such a core kind of thing, right? Yeah, so it's a loaded word in that way. So, but then for those of us who feel that it's like, let's not use it because it's a loaded word, can we trust the use of this word? Just as this, you know, or practicing with fear around such a word. We had another practice period at Tassajara where the theme was evil. Because somehow the word came up at the beginning of the practice period. Somebody's like, can we not use that word? That's a totally loaded word. It has nothing to do with Buddhism. And I think it's true. It's, you know, it's a Judeo-Christian term. But it gets translated from Japanese sometimes as evil. And but because of that very reason, this was with Tenzin Roshi, he's like, let's discuss evil for 3 months. Evil and sin we brought in there too. Just because they're such loaded words, can we like unpack them? Can we redefine them? Can we play with these words? And look at them in this new context. Words and meaning create our help to create our particular boxes. So, with all that in mind, I might lose your trust completely if I don't stop this talk right now. May our intention equally extend to every being and place with the true merit of Buddha's way. Beings are numberless. I vow to save them. Delusions are inexhaustible. I vow to end them. Dharma gates are boundless. I vow to enter them. Buddha's way is unsurpassable. I vow to become it.